Hello, it's October 27th, 2022. My name is Victoria Farrell Ortiz, interviewing Jinya. I'm located in Oak Cliff, Dallas, Texas for the Gone to Texas Oral History Project. Jinya, can you introduce yourself, share your pronouns, and share where you're located today?
Absolutely. My name is Jinya Huang. My pronouns are she, her, hers. I am located in Old Lake Highlands. That's a part of East Dallas, which is north of White Rock Lake in the Casa Linda area. For those of you who actually know all any of where this is, I'm really close to the Arboretum. How about that? Thanks.
I love the specificness of your answer.
This general vicinity. Yeah, thank you.
What is your ethnic background, Jinya?
So I grew up in Taipei, Taiwan. I was actually born in Hsinchu, which is a little town outside of Taipei. It actually means new bamboo. So Taipei literally means like the most northernest part of Taiwan, the city, and it is the capital. My ancestors are Chinese. My mother's side from the province of Guangdong, and my father's side from the province of Fujian, but in that in the proper Chinese dialect, it would be Hokkien. So I identify as Taiwanese, but I do have Chinese heritage.
Thank you. Where were both of your parents born, and what kind of work did they do?
So my parents were actually born in Taiwan, and they are from a south west part of the province. It's called Yunlin, which means cloud forest, actually. And I am seeing a yard truck. Uh-oh. Pulling up. I hope it's not for me. Anyways, if it is, this may get really noisy. Anyways, it's actually the one of the most impoverished provinces in Taiwan. My dad was born in a merchant village called Huwei, which means tiger tail, actually. And grandparents actually were fabric merchants. And then my mother's side, they were farmers. And so my maternal grandparents were in a little village called Douliu. It literally means six bushels. And so yeah, it's funny how the names are coincide with exactly what they do. But and so yeah, my dad actually was a mechanical engineer. He got to finish high school and went to a technical institute. And so he was a mechanical engineer for a cement factory when I was growing up. And then my mother actually started out as a seamstress. She never got to finish elementary school. She needed to actually there were eight children in the household. There were six girls and two boys, and so she was asked to actually stop schooling to work to help out with the family. And this was kind of the beginning of, my mother feeling very strongly about how girls needing to receive education. And she obviously, cooked and helped out around the house a lot. And so when my dad lost his job when I turned 13, Taipei was really expensive because it's a very metropolitan city compared to the south where my parents were born. And so when they moved to a bigger city to get us, better educational opportunities, it really affected our economic standing. And so when he lost his job, it was really challenging. I grew up with five sisters, and so there. Can you actually hear the noises? Oh, you can't. Okay, it may get closer. Anyways, so my parents had heard from my dad's younger brother, who was here in America already. They were actually in Missouri at the time. And my uncle actually went to school for a doctorate in chemistry, and my aunt, this is my uncle's my dad's younger brother. And then so the woman that he ended up, my uncle ended up marrying, my aunt had a MBA. And so they were, sorry about the noise. Is it bad?
Maybe we could take a break. Do you think
let's take a break for them to leave. Yeah. I could ask them just to leave, but this is probably okay. Thank you. So, my parents were, from the province of Yunlin, which means cloud forest. And it was one of actually the most impoverished provinces in Taiwan. And so my dad actually was born in Huwei, which means tiger's tail or tiger tail. And the paternal side, the grandparents were fabric merchants. And so my dad finished high school and was able to become a mechanical engineer at a cement factory. And he actually worked on site all throughout the years that I was in Taiwan. So he loved being at the factory. I used to kind of joke because I grew up with five sisters. And so including my mom, there was like seven girls in the house, and we had one bathroom. And maybe that was why my dad didn't want to come home, because he actually he was at the cement factory. He was on site. He only came home twice a year, so like Lunar New Year and maybe like a winter break or a fall break. You know, when the kids were more home, and he would come home and visit. And so that was like the norm for like 12 years when I was growing up. And then my mom was a seamstress, and she actually had to quit school at like sixth grade. She never got to finish elementary school because girls are like buckets of water, like spilled water. You don't really invest in. That's a lot of the ancient Asian culture. It's actually an old Chinese saying that married daughters, you know, are like water poured out that you can't ever get back. And so most people don't invest in girls. They only more so invested in boys. And so my mom was asked to start working right away, and she knew how to sew. And so that was really, really helpful to the family for her to, you know, help earn an income to help support the families. Like I learned how to sew on one of those pedal Singer sewing machines, like your grandmother did, I'm sure. And it's takes forever, but you know, once you get into a rhythm of it, it's actually quite interesting. And my parents actually met through an arranged marriage, because my dad has served in the National Army, because Taiwan being so small, it's just like Israel. Every person or every man has to serve in the military. And so my dad was in the army. And when he came home, he actually didn't have any civilian clothes. And so my grandmother on my dad's side actually saved a bunch of fabric and said, oh, you know, there's, you know, this tailor in the village, just, you know, in a neighboring village in Six Bushels, which is Doliu, where my mom grew up. And, you know, you can just go and get some clothes made. And so my dad went, and my mom was the new apprentice there. And he like kind of forgot all about the clothes and just kind of ran home and told my grandmother that he finally met the love of his life and she should hire the matchmaker. And the rest, as they say, is history. So it was really fun to hear that story, because you know, for a long time, like any married couple, you know, whenever they fought, like cats and dogs, I would remind them, you know, remember how you met. And so that was kind of what they did in Taiwan. And and my mom, being one of six girls, always helped out with the cooking. Definitely like just an amazing talent in the kitchen. And so when my dad actually lost his job when I turned 13, my aunt and uncle were already here in America, and they were starting a restaurant franchise business. It was called Egg Roll Express. And they started them in Tulsa, Oklahoma, out of all places. And when they heard that my dad, you know, was kind of looking for something as a next step, they told my parents about the restaurant. They had one fancy formal restaurant called Peking Garden already that did really well. And they were like, oh, we're going to do like a fast food concept. And so Egg Roll Express kind of went head to head with like Panda Express, obviously lost, but they were successful at one point. There was like 16 franchises throughout the Southwest. And my parents, you know, kind of thought about it. And with six girls to raise, it was really tough. And it got really expensive in Taipei when they moved up north so we can have more access to education. And so in Taipei, like my oldest sister had actually already gotten engaged, and my second oldest sister was you know, like seeing somebody very serious that we knew that, you know, the first one was already basically like engaged, married off, and the second one was, you know, really like in a good spot. She had finished formal college and was going to teach. And so my parents said, okay, the two oldest girls are going to stay in Taiwan. And so they brought the four younger sisters here to America. So we actually first came to Tulsa, Oklahoma from Taipei, Taiwan first. And then that was where a lot of the restaurants were. Uh-oh. Here they're back.
Okay, I can hear it a little bit. Is it very distracting for you? Oh no, okay.
Just when I thought they were done. So thank you for your patience. So when we came to the States, it was actually first to Tulsa, Oklahoma from Taipei, Taiwan. And there, my mom was actually babysitting, was really my cousin's nanny. And so my aunt and uncle had hired my mom first to be their nanny. And then my dad was helping out with the restaurants. And so he was a restaurant manager. And so it was a huge shift from mechanical engineer to a restaurant manager. But, you know, they did everything they could. They sacrificed like their whole lives, you know, to come here. My dad was 47 at the time, and my mom was 43. And like my dad spoke a little bit of English, and my mom didn't speak any. And so she started out, you know, as kind of like helping my aunt and uncle with my cousins. And I want to say my cousins were 8. Jason was 8 at the time, and Janice was like 4, and my baby sister was 7, and I was 12 at the time. And so my mom started out as the nanny, and then my aunt discovered how great of a cook she was, started asking her to come basically cook in the kitchen. And she started, you know, helping her replicate the recipes, you know, for the franchises. And so eventually some of the franchises, you know, came to Texas, to, you know, all the different neighboring states. And that's how they got to so many franchises around here. And there was a franchise here in Dallas, Texas, that my parents thought did really well, that was over in Farmers Branch. And that's why we moved to Dallas. And so their lives kind of, you know, change from like, you know, mechanical engineer to restaurant manager, and then seamstress to chef. It was big transitions.
That sounds like it. It sounds like a lot of pivoting, which is good. Could you describe your childhood? What events or things do you remember about growing up?
The events I remember about growing up. How many minutes do we have for this? The biggest, the strongest memories would probably be, I knew that my mother was blamed for having girls a lot. They didn't know back then that, you know, the sperm is what determines the gender. And so my grandmother on my father's side used to beat my mother every time we went to Tiger Tail to visit. And they, my grandmother would verbally abuse us and tell us that we were really dumb and stupid children that, you know, grew up in Taipei and didn't know how to speak Hokkien or Taiwanese, because we were asked to speak Mandarin in school, and that's more the universal dialect. And a lot of times you were prevented from speaking any provincial dialects because that was considered like the improper or the country bumpkin or the, you know, the silly thing to do. And this was also done to Indigenous people because we weren't the first people on Taiwan. There were already Aborigines and Native Taiwanese people there. And so this is where I struggle a lot calling myself Taiwanese, because I'm not actually Native Taiwanese. There are people that, you know, who were on the island already. They're coming back again. Oh my goodness, these yard people.
I wonder, is there a possibility of, like, are you on a laptop where you can pick it up and, like, move
to? I can, yeah. It's just like, if I go to the back, they're probably just gonna go to the back also.
Okay.
Here, let me just, yeah, let me just go. It's like not gonna. Yeah, there's somebody back here too, but it's not as bad as the leaf blower. Let's see. Okay, I'll just like be like away from them. Okay. That's better, right?
Yes, yes, it is. Okay, cool.
All right, which part? The childhood memory.
Yes,
your grandmother. Yeah, so my grandmother beating my mother. This is on my dad's side. She didn't understand why my mother couldn't produce a male heir to carry down the Huang torch. And so, and I remember she would berate us, the kids, in person, and say that we didn't, you know, speak the her dialect, her language, and therefore we were dumb and stupid. And so, like, it was really challenging going to visit my paternal side of the family because of the just the words that were the narrative around, like, girls are worthless. And also, if we didn't do what we were told, we weren't of any value to the family. And so that was really challenging. And yeah, I remember when we would visit, my mom would get beaten, and then she would try to sneak back into the bedroom to bed crying. But we would see the lash marks, you know, then the next day when she was getting dressed, and she tried to hide it as much as she could, but we heard everything. Like, we knew what was happening, but nobody ever talked about it, you know? And so we knew why we moved up north. It was because we needed safety, and my mom was trying to provide us that. And my dad, I think, did the best that he could, but he couldn't stop his own parents, you know, his own mother, from doing these horrible things to us. And the best he could do is, you know, like, we were supposed to visit during holidays, but holidays were, like, kind of horrendous. And so, yeah, I remember that part. And I remember when my paternal grandmother passed away, the Chinese custom is that you so, like, we rode the train from Taipei to Hubei, and there at the train station there's a bus stop, and you take the bus into, you know, the village, but then from the bus stop you had to, like, walk this long gravel road, and I don't even remember how long it was, you know, from the bus stop to the to their home. And it's this long gravel road. And like for when my grandmother passed away, the funeral process is that you on that long gravel road, you don't just walk it, you crawl on your hands and knees to show your grief, right? And so I was crawling on my hands and knees and bleeding, but I was so happy, ding dong, the witch is dead. And I knew that I wasn't supposed to feel that way. I was 9 years old and I was like devastated that I was happy that someone died, but it was somebody that was hurting my mother, you know, for years and years and hurting us for years and years. And I just knew it wasn't right, you know? And so a lot of the sense of justice like came when I was really young, just like watching these things happen and thinking that I couldn't do anything about it. You know, meanwhile, on the other end, on my maternal side of the family, it was like nothing but unconditional love, you know, and it was like, it was just such a total opposite from my maternal grandmother. Now, my maternal grandfather was kind of kind of hardcore. He was pretty intense. And, you know, being a farmer, he was like, woke me at 3 a.m., you know, whenever I came down for summer vacation, I had a whole list of feeding the fish, cleaning the pig pen, and, you know, watering the cabbage and, you know, mingle orchards, you know, like if I had to pick something, like I was like free child labor, you know, like my cousins and I, like there was like no playtime, like you know, that was what you were supposed to do. And it was really funny because like out of all the six girls, like for some odd reasons, I was always like the only one that ended up on the farm. And I never really like asked my mother about this, and I wish I did, but for some, I just kind of assumed that because I was like the most unruly one. I've always been kind of the black sheep, just really different from my sisters. Like when you meet my sisters, you'll be like, Jinya, one of these things don't belong. and I will tell you, Victoria, I was adopted. I was picked up by the river. I'm an artist, the black sheep. All my sisters are analysts, supply chain specialists, and you know, like, you know, I think the closest one may be the music teacher, but even her, she's like, so like logistics operations, like, you know, like her kids, like are like, she produced like, you know, kids who are like, you know, dentists and, you know, cellos, like super successful. And like, and it was really funny to kind of like look back and think like, what did I define as success? You know, because for my grandparents, you know, like selling fabric on the street wasn't successful, you know, coming to America to go to school is very successful. And, you know, those definitions were so interesting, you know, like how we measured, what those metrics were, you know, for success. And, so just having those vivid childhood memories, like, you know, if my grandfather on my mom's side would say, hey, you know, like, go catch some fish for dinner. And like, I would always take the shortcut. Like I would take the net and go to like the shadowy part of the tree under, you know, like the lake. And that's kind of where all the fish would go for shade. And basically, like, I would just catch a bunch of fish, and big and small, when I was really supposed to only get the big ones. And but then my grandmother would say, she did great. You know, don't punish her for, you know, catching the little ones. But she did great. She fished more smartly and not, you know, not harder, you know, and she would just cook all the fish. And, you know, and like, so much of the love language came from food instead of words. And so you just kind of found your ways around it, you know, but yeah, with that family, it was a lot more accepting. And so it was almost always like, kind of like the worlds of like good and evil almost, you know, kind of coexisted in like both sides of the family. And so those were some of the really like strong childhood memories of like my grandparents that really shaped my parents, of how they parented and how they raised us and what the expectations were. Yeah, that's it for that. I'm sure there's other things that we can unpack as we go.
Thank you so much. That was wonderful. What were some of your first memories of the United States?
We came by plane. And I remember that was the first time I was on an airplane. I was really mad at my parents for taking me away from my friends. And I was scared and excited because I had just finished sixth grade and I was starting seventh grade. I just started my alphabets and learning the ABCs, but I didn't speak English at the time. And so 13 is just an odd age, right, to go anywhere. And it was a good transitional age. So I remember we came through LAX. And so in the middle of the airport, my dad got really lost because we had all these luggages and we were supposed to, do the layover flight from LAX to Tulsa. And after having gone through customs, we got turned around a bit. And so my father had asked for directions to get to our gate, and he didn't know where to go. And so he asked this man for directions, and the guy took one look at us and said, $20, 20 bucks. I'll tell you where to go. And my father, desperate, right? He's got his whole family around him and just watching this transaction happen. And he didn't want to lose face. And so he produced the money out of his pocket and handed it to the guy, and the guy walks around the corner and there it was. And I remember, oh my goodness, like I knew America was going to be tough, but I didn't think it was going to be this tough. And it was, and it was just like the discrimination we had faced, you know, from being girls, being poor, you know, being socioeconomically like disadvantaged, you know, from so many fronts. And like my parents, you know, growing up, surviving the war, you know, dodging shelling, you know, to go to school. My father had to have like was forced Japanese education from Taiwan being Formosa, and the colonization, the oppression, and, you know, being one of many girls, my mom not being allowed to go to school, so many of that, like it was just flooding back. Like it wasn't enough. Like we were, I think I was at that point of like, I knew we weren't going to escape everything, but I didn't know how much more difficult it was going to be. And when that moment hit, it was like, oh, it's going to be a lot worse. And before it gets better, I think, you know, like, I think my mom was always the one that had a lot more hope, you know, and my dad was like more the pessimist. And I hope I'm a little bit of the combination of the two, but it was difficult watching that happen. That was our first interaction coming to America.
How long did the process of migration take? Were there any challenges that you can remember for your parents and like filling out paperwork or anything like that?
It was a long, arduous journey. It took more than probably 10 years, in my opinion, for the migration to actually work. And so that comfort level, I don't think is ever really there. Did we feel welcomed for the most part? Maybe. I think there were definitely people that you know, that had really big hearts, like the Uncle Norman and Aunt James of the world. But did we feel included with our own family that were flesh and blood? Absolutely not. And it really produced a huge rift between the adults, especially my aunt and uncle, and also my mom and dad. And my mom was the one that really kind of like kept us all together. My dad was like, we can sever ties now. Like, you know, you don't do that to family, you know? And so that part made the migration very, very tough.
Where did you go to school and college, if you went to college, and what did you study?
I went to University of Texas at Dallas because that was the closest place I could go to school and actually still work at the restaurant. So unlike all my sisters who decided we're going to get hitched and leave the restaurant, or I'm going to pick the closest school that is far away enough that I can't work at the restaurant anymore. So that was my baby sister strategy. She went to UC Austin and she was like, see ya, wouldn't want to be ya. And my two older sisters got married, and one moved back to Tulsa and the other one was stayed here. You know, was close, but definitely just, you know, was like a part of her husband's family, and that was it. And she was no longer able to help out with the restaurant. And so I was the only girl left at the only child left at the restaurant. And so I felt really responsible, you know, to stay and help my parents. And so I went to UTD. That was the closest school. And I really wanted to study the arts, because I just have this affinity towards everything that is creative. And I knew ever since I was three that I wanted to be an artist. But being raised Asian and coming to America, it was just like, I thought the expectations was to study, you know, business or, you know, medicine or law, like, you know, all these other, you know, aunties and uncles that we knew, like that's what their kids were doing. Like, you know, my parents didn't sacrifice their whole entire life, you know, for me to like go study the arts. And so I started out as a international business major, and I was failing accounting and math and science just miserably. And at one point it was just like, I have to come to terms with this. I can't just like keep changing my major, and I can't count on the Patel girls to like, you know, help me through statistics every time, you know, like somewhere, I have to like really like pony up. And so, that ended up was basically, what happened. And I had to have like a moment of truth, you know, with my parents and say, I really want to study arts and humanities. I want to, you know, major in like literary studies and maybe minor in painting, or, you know, study photography and graphic design, like anything that is creative. I can't just do this whole, you know, business law, whatever. And my parents were like, that's totally cool. It's fine. Like, you're helping out with the restaurant. We'll help you with tuition as long as you're happy. Like, that's the most important thing to us. You know, we just want you to like go to college, get an education. And when we're dead and gone, you can take care of yourself. Then like you're self-sufficient. Then that's all we care about. Cause you know, if you go to study something that's for us, then, you know, this is not for you. And if you're not happy, we're not happy. And I was like, why didn't you tell me this sooner? They were like, we did. You just didn't listen. And I was like, oh yeah, because I was young and stupid. That's right. And so, yeah, it took a long time, to figure that out, but that's where I went to school, and that's what I studied.
Thank you. Did you, or do you participate in any community events or organizations, and how did you build community in your young adult life and now?
In my young adult life, because I was so interested in the arts, that was like a really huge part of my focus. And I became an abstract artist. And so my visual art form was definitely in photography. And so I invested a lot of that into the community in the beginning, just realizing that, you know, art is my love language, and that's what I did to share with the world, and showing in galleries, you know, and in New York, Miami, and Dallas was really a nice part of being a part of the community. And so I was raised Buddhist, and so my parents were really involved with the Buddhist Compassion Relief Foundation, which did a lot of disaster relief and, you know, social work. And so, like, I grew up volunteering with my parents. Really, my mom was the one that did a lot of this. She was raising us to be like tiny philanthropists. She was like, we may not have the money, but we always have the time. And the time is the most valuable thing that you can share with your communities. And so we grew up, you know, like me singing very off key, you know, tone deaf, you know, at nursing homes. And because she was a seamstress before my mom became a chef, she taught us how to sew blankets, you know, for people who were in shelters and who are experiencing homelessness, or, you know, after a big disaster needed, you know, blankets and things, you know, to keep warm. And because my mom was such an amazing chef, that she would cook for galas, for hundreds, you know, for the temple's fundraisers. And it didn't matter, you know, if of anybody's, you know, racial, socioeconomic backgrounds, you know, once the casework came in, she just gave herself, you know, very selflessly to help out. And so cooking was definitely one of her superpowers. And growing up, like I watched my mom, you know, transform other refugee immigrants and migrants' lives. In our kitchen, she would just train all these people with job skills and send them onto bigger and better opportunities. No matter the language barrier, she just really knew, like, you know, if she could do this, not speaking any English, not knowing how to drive, and if she was able to learn these job skills and do bigger and better things, that, you know, other people could do the same. And so I think, again, with the young and stupid theme, like, I just, you know, I didn't realize a lot of that growing up. And when my parents asked me, like, if I wanted to, you know, take over the restaurant when I was done with school, I was like, oh, no way, Jose, like, there is no way I want to ever be in the food business. This is a hard life, yo. Like, it's like 18-hour days at the minimum. And, you know, you're like, you get up at crack of dawn, you prep, and then, you know, you're still cleaning up at last minute. And, like, you know, you did everything. Like, we were like cleaning toilets, we were, you know, watching, like, you know, people, you know, prep, and like, it was just really, really hard work. And I knew that I was like, I'm going to run away to, you know, marketing and go into advertising and, you know, just like do whatever, anything, you know. I wanted to be on the creative side, you know, of things. And I did invest in a lot of that, you know, the artist community, because that's how I communicated. But then, losing my mom to cancer, she passed away from multiple myeloma back in 2015. Margaret Maying Huang was her name, and she just poured so much into the community and invested in so much as a chef, as a restaurateur, as a leader. I didn't want any of that to just be gone. And so in honor of her legacy, we founded Break Bread, Break Borders, a social enterprise to work with refugee women from war-torn countries, and using storytelling, the oral history aspect, to share the history of food and culture, and, you know, giving a face, you know, to everything, you know, that was produced. And we basically cook food for good. And really pouring into the community in this way, using art and food, you know, my love language, my mother's love language, and combining the two, we've really been just invested in social justice and in you know, collective impact. Yeah, it's it's an interesting transition, because I think, you know, now that I'm a single mom and to a 14-year-old boy, just realizing like how much my mom, you know, made this world a better place for me to grow up in. I really want to do my part, you know, for my son to have a better world to grow up in. And so, so I'm just, you know, doing my best to honor my mother's legacy. Yeah.
Legacy work. I love it.
It is. It's all about legacy impact. I mean, you know, because it's never too early. And it's never too late, you know, to think about, you know, what that looks like, sounds like, or feels like.
Janya, I know that we are at the time that we scheduled for, but if you can continue talking, I am happy to press on in the interview. What do you think?
Yeah, I think I'm okay for another, like, maybe I need to double check the time. I don't think I have a meeting until 11, actually. So let me just check on something real quick. I'll put this on pause and I'll be right back. Okay. Okay.
So the next question I have for you is, what historic events have had an impact on your life and how?
What historical events have had an impact on me and how? I think when I was mentioning about World War II and what happened to my parents and living through the war and surviving it and just experiencing all the trauma from that. And even for my grandparents to go through those kind of hardship and escaping war to find safety for us, like we were talking about the migration and all that. I think there's so many of those historical events that happen that creates that intergenerational trauma. And a lot of times I feel like those things are in your bones, that it's not something that you can, in fact, there's a writer that talks about this, and I forget her name now. Is it Stephanie Fu or Fung? And so, you know, that kind of thing, like trying to figure out what to do with it. I think it affects different people in different ways. And I think for some people, they process it internally. And I think at one point for me, it was like listening to activists like Grace Lee Boggs saying, you know, we're the leaders that we've been looking for, instead of waiting for Superman to come and save us. It's like, if not you, you know, who, if not now, when, you know, that kind of thing. And, you know, and Helen Shaw used to talk about, still does, like, silence is a privilege. You know, we can go through these injustices and not speak a word of it, which is what a lot of refugees and immigrants and migrants do, is you keep your head down, you work through things. And if you work hard enough, somebody will recognize you and you'll be, like, you know, celebrated for it or compensated for it or, you know, or thanked for it. But it doesn't happen like that. And I think it just got to a point where I'm looking at, you know, different events. You know, we could go even further back, you know, to the Chinese Exclusion Act and, you know, coolies going around the world finding work and trying to figure out, well, where are we welcomed and where can we work? Where can we find safety? Where can we, you know, find a economic harbor? And, you know, to this day, even how a refugee is defined, you know, it's by war, it's by trauma, it's by It's not even by climate change. Like, you know, that doesn't count if you're escaping from any kind of, you know, climate change and issues. It doesn't count if you're trying to escape economic hardship. It doesn't count if you're just trying to, they say just trying to, you know, escape, you know, violence, gang violence, and, you know, drug violence. And it doesn't count as refugees if you're trying to escape from that. Like, our definitions and our metrics for success also comes into play when we talk about the metrics for devastation. And I really challenge that term. You know, what is trauma? What is, you know, what is the cost of not learning your history and understanding which side you want to be on? Those are really tough to see and understand. And because for so long, if it wasn't for my mother telling me about the Aborigines and how they were drove to the mountains and forced to speak Mandarin, not to speak their own native dialect, not to practice their ceremonial dances and to preserve their culture and heritage and history, you know, being like tortured in that way. Like, I would have never known that side of history, because it's all, you know, like the brainwashing and the propaganda that goes around it, you know, was so blinding for so long. And it was, you know, if it wasn't for my father telling me what happened to him, you know, during the war, and you know, the Japanese education that was forced on him, and, you know, seeing his family members, you know, being raped and killed, and, you know, becoming comfort women, and you know, those terminologies, those words being used, and even just, you know, at like, he still speaks Japanese fluently to this day because of that, you know. And it's like, is it a blessing? I'm not so sure, you know. And like, it's, you know, those long-term effects, you know, are so devastating. And to hear about, you know, the food rations that happened, you know, from, you know, soy sauce, rice to eggs. And, you know, even in a farming village like my mother's, they weren't allowed to eat their own food. They were supposed to export out the flour and, you know, to feed the government and the, you know, the military families, anybody but themselves. And that's how that province, even though is the most, you know, productive in cranking out, you know, food supply and the grains and everything necessary for the country to recover, it became the poorest, the most impoverished province, because they were asking people to give and not get back. And it was like, you could tell by even just the years of studies of food nutrition, how much as farmers, they were experiencing food insecurities themselves. Like, that's tough to hear, but I didn't know any of that. You know, I didn't know any of that. They kept so much of it away from us because we were kids, and they didn't want us to, you know, like, feel the pain or understand the trauma. They just wanted to, like, you know, shield us from all that and, you know, and get us to safety. But so much of it is in our bones. Like, we know, we remember, and in these, you know, current day events, from the anti-Asian hate, from COVID, from the shooting, from everything that's happening in our backyard, you know, racial slurs, and, you know, being working at the restaurant. I still remember, yeah, people, you know, when somebody was unhappy about something, you know, go back to wherever the fuck you came from, go back to your own country. You don't belong here. You're not welcome. You know, all those words hurt. And, you know, and that's the thing, it's the trickle down of all that, you know, from all the historical events, you re-remember so many of the things because it is experienced through your bones, your DNA, all that, your blood, like, you remember, and we remember, and we we'll never forget. And it's like, you know, how do we move forward from that, you know, together? That is a lot that I think, you know, I have been thinking about. You know, there's never really just like one historical event that really turns the pages. It's the multitude of them that I just realized, like, oh, this triggered this, and this reminds me of that. And here's what I think of this. And instead of just, you know, sweeping everything under the rugs, like a lot of our people normally do, you know, having the gumption and to speak up and using our voice to, you know, to tell the truth. And like, as truth tellers, as an artist, especially as a social practice artist, like, one of my main models is, you know, when our community asks for fire, we don't bring it water. And, you know, and that is like, it seems so simple, yet it's really difficult to practice, right? You know, and like the listening skill, the understanding, you know, capacity, like there's so many things that come along, you know, with that journey. And so I can't really say if there's like, you know, any particular historical events, but I do feel like, you know, the stories that my ancestors and my families and, you know, the people around us that have been able to share fuels us to see what work needs to be done and the necessary troubles that we need to start, you know, to find those creative solutions. And innovation is never about like, you know, like reinventing the wheel. You know, sometimes it's just that little twist of a, you know, of adjustment that we can, you know, like find a better way, you know, and it will take a lot, you know, of people, you know, to get there together. But having these tough conversations and learning our history and, you know, really like seeing the path together, like that's, it's a lot of work, but it's something that, you know, we see, we deem necessary. Yeah.
Thank you. What kinds of traditions and practices do you keep, and why do you continue to practice them?
Oh, there are a lot of things culturally very Chinese that I used to throw a Lunar New Year party because I was like, oh, after, you know, like when in Rome, do as the Romans do. Yeah, you know, we did a lot of Thanksgiving, Christmas, and, you know, New Year kind of thing. But you know, I never felt at home when it was like, you know, everybody else's holiday but mine. And so when I started throwing the Lunar New Year parties, and like my mom would make dumplings and we would invite people, you know, to come through my house, and it was so nice to be able to have people under one roof and just share a meal. And, you know, like people would ask me like, are you cooking? And I'd be like, no, my mom is. And they're like, oh, as long as your mom's cooking, we're there. If you're cooking, oh, I'm not so sure about that, you know, but, and it was so fun to have, you know, like my parents would, you know, my dad would be like, you're wasting so much money, you know, and I don't know why, you know, you volunteer to do this kind of work. It's so silly, you know, and my mom would be like, this is so great. You know, people from all walks of life, you know, I would have never imagined for this for you kids. And she was like, always so proud, you know, and like, it was just like, it was like, my dad was like the grumpy old man, still is, and conspiracy theorist to the core. And my mom was just like unconditional, loving everything, you know, is great. Like, I will love you and support you no matter what, you know? And it was just like, it was so, so funny and great and like funny, haha, you know, like to have both sides of that, you know? And I think they instilled so much of it in us in that way that like I practice things, you know, a lot of the feng shui, right? You know, feng being wind, shui being water, and just like watching the flow and the qi, you know, of the world and celebrating, you know, okay, you want to have a green fig plant preferably real, for a money tree. It's like, my dad's like, millions of people don't practice feng shui. Okay. And I think they're just fine. And my mom is like, it's our culture. It's how we were raised. This is our heritage. We're going to give red envelopes, you know, and money. And my dad's like, no, not money. We don't give away money. You know, and it's just like, they were so polar opposites. Sometimes it's like, so working with them at the restaurant was like the worst and also the best, you know, at the same time. It's just like watching, like, you know, like all this. And you're just like, gosh, why are you still together? Oh, you stay together because of the kids, you know, and like, they'll just kind of go back and forth. And, you know, and you know, we'll eat lucky foods on days like, you know, birthdays. You eat, you know, long noodles for longevity, so you always have long life. And, you know, you wish each other well, and there's never a parting word of goodbye. It's, I will see you again. You know, like, there's so many words that and tradition and that we honor, that, you know, some of this may seem silly, but, you know, we talk about like going to cemeteries, like, you know, carrying a special little envelope, white envelope with a particular little grass that's called love leaf or love grass, and with a little money inside to keep the evil spirits away. And it's just a practice. Maybe some people think it's a superstition, you know, like my ex hated this, and he's like fifth generation Slovenian. He was always like, you did all these stupid things and you're making our son do these stupid things. And I'm like, he's half Taiwanese and half Slovenian. He's gonna do these things to honor his heritage and culture. How else is he going to identify as a person, you know? And my ex used to joke, like, are you just doing these dumb things? And, you know, but like, through this, like, my son has gotten to know this, you know, that the half of him that he understands. It's like, yes, this is like what we do, you know. We will eat, you know, oranges for you know, lucky food because it rhymes with prosperity. Pineapple, the same thing. And, you know, fish rhymes with the word, you know, savings, and so you always have money to take care of people, yourself and people. Like, all these things that I honor, you know, along the way, that it's to remember and re-remember our ancestors and celebrate them, you know. And to me, it's like, it's always going to come back to food somehow. But a lot of it is just like, you know, everyday things. And I have fun sharing those with people. And the last thing that we were interviewed for was for mooncakes. And we talked about the mythical legend. And, you know, I don't know if you read that article. And, you know, and we talked about, you know, the warring periods, and, you know, how they used it, you know, actual history, used mooncakes to literally pass war strategies. And that's how they won against, you know, Mongolian conquerors. And it's like, there's so many different aspects that comes through this. And it's like, if you don't share that, like, how else are you supposed to know you, as a people, you know? And like, recently my son, I saw that, you know, he's taking these AP classes in high school, and I had to dive in to kind of like, you know, pay for the exams so they get college credit. And so, I went to his profiles just to look, because I'm nosy. And and you know how, like, you know, in the racial ethnicities, you know, you can check boxes and whatever, and they always like make you pick one. And like I said, he's half Taiwanese and half Slovenian, and he checked the box for Asian. Like, he identifies as Asian. And I'm like, damn, I'm so proud. all that brainwashing worked. Like, I'm like laughing like a mad scientist, like, oh, the corruption worked, you know. But that was the thing. It's like, his dad like knows how to curse in Slovenian, you know, and like, fifth generation, you know, coming through Ellis Island, like, they moved to Cleveland, Ohio, and, you know, grew up in Euclid, and like that's the extent of it. Yeah, they'll have blood sausage, you know, around, you know, holidays and whatever. There was so few of those traditions and heritage, like cultural celebrations, that like, it was really difficult for Lang to like, really like, you know, bond with that and to like, identify with that and to celebrate with that. Whereas like me, it's like every day there's something weird. It's like, oh, mommy does this, you know, and it's like, but it's me and I have fun doing it, you know, and sometimes it feels like a beating, you know, like, oh boy, we can't go to a cemetery, you know, and it's like, what if it's Dios de los Muertos? It's like, we're going to a different celebration. Oh no, we still got to carry the love grass and the money in the white envelope, like, cause that's the Chinese thing, you know, and like, but that's just it. Like we really like celebrate that all together. And so that's the fun part that I think, you know, I love sharing these stories so people understand it more. I love, you know, being able to pass it down, you know, to my son. And I even love like, you know, letting his friends know, like one of his best friends, in school is half, Vietnamese and half white, and you know, going further with that mooncake story, recently with the Mid-Autumn Moon Festival, we, you know, got little baby mooncakes, you know, from 85 Degrees and also Gen Chi Bakery to hand out to people as gifts, you know, and all weird flavors like date and taro and you know, and it's like some normal, you know, coconut, some pineapple, blah, 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 you know, like really fun, different, fillings, you know, inside. And Colton, like Colton's mom never taught him any of that. They were just very westernized and assimilated. And so like, and his dad, you know, who's white, who is, you know, co-parenting with the mom, like, you know, was like, we just never talked about it. He was like, what are mooncakes? And I'm like, dude, here you go. And he was like, and they had them. And he was like, I had no idea this whole side to my son's culture that like, he was like, I want to celebrate this every day. And like, I love the joy in that. It's like, oh, you know, it's not, if he came through it because of his son being half Vietnamese, great. But if he came through it, just me sharing the story because I'm crazy and weird and I want to like, you know, like just like shout it out from the rooftop and the mountaintop and say like, this is how great my culture is. And this is what I practice in my heritage. Here's a little gift, you know, of my history with you. Then by all means, like, let's do it together, you know? And so I think that was like really fun doing that. And Lang's always a little bit like, my son's always like a little bit like, you know, it's like, it's a little cringy when you do that, mommy, like, especially when you go into the time loop with people, like you can't stop talking and like just zip it. And, you know, and he's like, but sometimes it's really fun to watch my friend's eyes light up because they learn something new from you that I know is like, you know, he's like, it may be boring to me, but it's all a part of us. And it's fun to watch, you know, people really like enjoy and celebrate our cultures together. And he's like, sometimes it's a little weird, but sometimes it's like, it's okay.
I love that. Have your views about living in the United States changed over time? And if so, how?
I think, you know, I really look forward to getting my U.S. citizenship because that was the moment that I thought I was really going to like feel like I'm a part of it and I really belonged. Surprisingly, like I hear those stories from my friends a lot. I recently interviewed, moderated a talk with Qian, Julie Wong, on her book Beautiful Country, of her undocumented childhood here in America. And she talked about how her citizenship, the swearing ceremony, being undocumented for so long, and at, you know, age, I think she was like 33 when she was like, she actually sworn in and she actually felt like she belonged. And then I talked to another friend who's also Asian American, and her heritage, you know, really kind of like made her feel like she was an other for the longest time. And so when she swore in as a Frisco City Council, she was like, oh, I'm here now. Like, I finally belong. And to me, I really thought, like, you know, that was going to be it for me. Because when I was traveling with my Taiwanese passport, one time I actually went to, this is like such a first world problem, but like, I thought that I had called the embassy and asked if I needed any special documentation. And they were like, no, you have your green card, you have your Taiwanese passport. You should be fine visiting Paris, France. And so, like, I remember it was like some crazy deal. Like, I just graduated from college and all my friends were going, and they were there already. I had something else going on. So I had to like meet them separately on a different trip. And when I arrived, they looked at my passport and they said, oh, you're from the People's Republic of China. And I said, no, I'm from the Republic of China. That's different. And this is literally lies the different, you know, the political standpoint of, you know, Taiwan is considered a runaway province from China, and seeking independence and democracy, whereas China practices communism. And so this French immigration officer basically was like, doesn't matter, you're going to need a visa, and you need to go back to the United States to get this. She proceeds to handcuff me. It was just one of those plastic handcuffs, but still, it's like the shame of it, right? You know, to be escorted, you know, from the office and, you know, all the way back on the plane. And of course, it was like, oh my God, they're sending me back to Boston. And what am I going to do? And so a part of me wanted to, like, you know, and I'm like calling, you know, my friends and telling them this horror story. And they were like, oh my God, like, you know, what are you going to do? And, you know, and so many of them were just like, you know, like, are you going to go back to Dallas? And I'm like, oh, hell no. I mean, part of me wanted to go back and just like, I wanted to curl up in the fetal position and just cry. And, you know, but the other part of me was like, fuck a bunch of this, like, how dare they? And, you know, and I was like, this is really traumatizing, but like, how do I rise from the ashes from this? And I remember like somebody on the plane, actually the guy who sat next to me, was like, oh my goodness, that's the worst thing that could happen to anybody. And he was like, you know, my wife is Moroccan and I'm American. And so when I, you know, when she, you know, became a citizen, she really celebrated, you know, getting that little, you know, little blue book, passport. And in fact, you know, but she still needs, you know, a visa to go visit Morocco, and, you know, because of the dual citizenship thing, I have to take her to the embassy tomorrow, and I'm happy to like drive you if you trust me, and we can go, you know, together. And because you don't know anybody in Boston, do you? I was like, no. And he goes, I will buy you a meal, and like, just, you know, like, you know, if you trust me, like, I would, you know, love to do this. And I was like, are you sure? And he was like, we're all immigrants from somewhere. And he's like, we can celebrate this together. And he goes, my kids love Levi's. You know, they're going to be all American, but we all came from every place else. And it's like, he was like, we can celebrate this together. And he was actually the restaurant manager for Cheers. Do you know the bar that like you could, he was the restaurant manager, and yes, Norm. And like, he took me there, had lunch. He dropped me off. After I talked to the American Airlines, you know, front desk, those ladies were like, we'll fly you back to Paris for $100. Don't worry. We're going to, like, this is a terrible story, but we're going to give you a voucher for hotels and vouchers for meals. And so like, you know, like, I got to stay there, and I flew out the next day after I got the visa, you know, from the embassy. And I proceeded to have a great trip with my college buddies, you know, like, all to celebrate our graduation. And I really didn't know if I wanted to become a citizen at that point. But at this point, it was almost like a in your face, you know, I am going to become a U.S. citizen, you know, just to like, you know, shove it in your face. And because I was debating whether to go back to Taiwan to teach or, you know, stay here. And that was a really pivotal moment for me, I think, you know, to really kind of feel like, oh, this is what I need to do. And I don't know if that answers your question entirely, but I felt that was, that was life-changing.
It's beautiful. And it definitely answers my question.
Okay, good.
I think that is so important to oral histories is that there's a storytelling component, and you are doing such a wonderful job, Janelle, the storytelling portion. I am having to skip some of the questions just for timeliness. Mm-hmm. But let me see. Have your views, you've kind of touched on this already, but I do want to ask you, have your views about living in the United States changed over time, specifically in regards to becoming an American citizen? And if so,
I think I always used to think I need to assimilate and become as American as possible to fit in. But then I realized that as Chinese as I am, I'm never going to, like, you can move a girl to Texas, but you can never take the Chinese out of her, you know, and the Taiwanese part is so inherently me that, you know, I do introduce myself as Taiwanese Texan sometimes. And I do embrace that. And there are a lot of people that, you know, a lot of times when I go up north or up East Coast, you know, they're like, it's only when you say y'all, and there are certain phrases that I'm like, yeah, you're not from around here, are you? And I'm like, yeah, definitely not. And I definitely embrace that I grew up in the South, and I definitely, you know, came from a different country, but I'm just as American as anybody else here. And just as American as, you know, my son who was born here. And I think a lot of times we have these conversations about, you know, what it means to be an American, but I really honestly think of it more as, you know, what it means to be a global citizen. And recently, like I went to visit my cousin in California, and she lives in the Bay Area. And she was like, you know, like I read, you know, the news, and I'm like aware of global affairs. And I'm like, no, I know. She goes, it's just so hard to find time to like do something about it. And I said, you're right. And at some point, you know, you just get to a comfort zone that you can either be complacent, or you stand up to fight the good fight. And for me, she was like, how can you live in Texas? It's just so like, and I go, well, it is so fill in the blank, but I can either run away and live very comfortably and ignore the fact that there's work to be done everywhere, even here in California, you know, and or I can stand tall, strong, and proud and stay with the tribes that I have built and found, and, you know, with the brothers and sisters that I know who are in it for the long run, you know, in it for the movement, in it with the people, by the people, for the people. Like, I can stay and fight. Like, that to me is so much more important. Like, I'm never going to bitch about how crappy Dallas is. It's like, if we forever compare ourselves to New York, LA, London, San Francisco, like Paris, you know, you name it, like if we continue to do that, nothing would ever be equitable. Like, look what's happening in Ukraine, Afghanistan, and in Yemen. Like, there's injustice all around the world. And we have to remember that when we lift our own neighbors, we lift ourselves. And the sooner we learn that, the better off we will be. And so I think, you know, that was the thing. It was like, it was very instrumental for me to really think about like our identity as a whole, and to embrace, you know, what those social responsibilities look like. And that's what makes us Texan American, and as wholehearted as that can be. Yeah, that's all we serve. You know, it's like, I'm really fortunate that I'm so grateful that I found my calling, you know, to be in this space. And it's like, did I want to be? No, it's so uncomfortable. it's like anytime I have to like speak, do public speaking, like Lang and I just both, like my son both and I just go, ooh, like shudder, you know, and like we have to like do a whole thing where we have to pump ourselves up. Like if he ever has to give like a book report, like we like do our little, you know, like thing, and like the day before or the, you know, moments before, and like we talk ourselves into it, you know, it's almost like a very like an ambivert, you know, decision, like, because we're super introverted, but you know, when we're amongst, you know, people that we trust, and you know, we're super extroverted, and being, you know, kind of ambidextrous in that part, like meshing the two together to find that spot that it's very uncomfortable being asked to lead, but it's what our community needs. And so how do we show up for it? You know, and like, I always joke with the ladies that I can't cook to save my life. I'm not my mom, but boy, I'm really good about showing up, and I'm really, really damn good at taking out the trash. And if that's my job, then that's my job, right? You know? And so like, that's what I'll do. That's how I contribute. And so, yeah. So thank you for letting me contribute by taking out the trash today. The CEO part is the chief of everything officer. It's not chief executive officer. It's you're taking out the trash, you're cleaning the toilet, you're doing everything. It's not just the
You are amazing. So
thank you.
This recording will be used as a resource in the future. So knowing that, how would you like people who know you to remember you, or if people have never met you in person, never been blessed enough to meet you in person, how would you like some of the listeners to be able to remember you?
Oh my goodness. My mom had these top three golden rules that I always love to share. Number one is always, always do the right thing. Number two is whatever you do, be a good neighbor. And number three is practice kindness and compassion every day. And I love how simple they are. Sometimes it is difficult to achieve, but I love how simple and easy they are to achieve. And I think she has just always focused on that, if you do what you love, the rest will come, you know, and that she centers so much on that unconditional love and, you know, coming from that place of just ultimate, like just incredible, like, you know, forever pouring love, and that she's just love and light, you know, personified. And I love that about her. And I want, you know, people to see that it's okay to embrace that. And it's, we need to find more love, you know, in our life, and more kindness, more compassion and moving forward. And so I would love for, you know, for people to really like embrace that together. And, cause a little bit goes a long way. And I think, those are the granules of truth. I think we would love to share with people. Yeah. I think there's an old Mexican saying, what is it? That you can actually die twice in your lifetime. Have you heard this? Like the first time is actually physically, like when you take your last breath. And then the second time is actually when people stop talking about you. Have you heard that before? A friend of mine, actually, Trisha, shared that with me. And I've always really loved that. And so like, you know, all these forms of love, you know, comes in different ways. And one of them, like, you know, I'll never stop talking about my mom, you know, like that's just, you know, that. And so to be able to share her love in this way with others. And I think, you know, however people choose to share that love, you know, going forward, it's just like spread it. Spread it all around. Yeah.
Uh-huh. I love that. That makes a lot of sense. Because Día de los Muertos and everything else that we celebrate. But I feel so honored to have spent this time with you today, Jinya. Thank you so much. Is there anything that you'd like to add about something that you shared that you feel might need clarification, anything like that?
No, not right now. I think I also need to hop off, but yeah, like anything else, I'll probably just, send you a note, but yeah, this is such, this has been such an honor. I'm so grateful to be able to share these parts of me with you and with everyone. So thank you again for this opportunity. Yeah.
Absolutely. If it's okay, I'll go ahead and end the recording now.
Sure.